Good evening, everyone. This is Terry Lynn Coop, host of the Blue Plate Special, and I am just totally jazzed tonight to have as our guest Mike Cole, author of the Gemini Cell series, Shadow Ops, and his newest series that's upcoming that we'll be talking about. Mike has translated a life in intelligence, the military, and law enforcement into a career as a TV personality, historian, and novelist. On the screen and on the page, he takes you right straight to the action. And as a security contractor, government civilian, and military officer, Mike's career has run the gamut from counterterrorism to cyber warfare to federal law enforcement. He did 3 tours in Iraq and was recalled to serve during the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. He was recently part of the cast of the TV show Hunted on CBS as part of an elite team of fugitive hunters. And all that conflict can wear a guy out. But right now, he also has gaming, Dungeons and Dragons, comic books, and writing to keep him going. How you doing, Mike?
Good. Thanks for having me. I'm excited.
This is fantastic. I was looking at it, you have 2 existing series, the Shadow Ops series and what I call the Gemini Cell series. Mm-hmm. And then you also have a new one coming up, which is going to be the Sacred Throne series. Am I correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's with Tor.com.
If someone wanted to dive into your writing, where's a good place to start?
The best place to start. So what you're calling the Gemini Cell series, I call it the Reawakening series. It's a prequel trilogy, events that take place before the Shadow Ops series. So the first book in that series, which would have been my 4th book that I published, Gemini Cell, is truly my first work in terms of my storyline. And I also think it's my best one. So if readers want to check me out, I'd start with Gemini Cell.
Why don't you give the short form version of what Gemini Cell is about?
The short form version is that a Navy SEAL who is a family man, loves his wife, loves his son, gets his identity compromised on and off, and he's assassinated. And he is brought back from the dead, and a demon is bound into his corpse. So he's sharing his body with a demon that grants him superpowers. And he's also immortal because he's undead, but is also constantly trying to corrupt him. And the only thing that Jim Schweitzer, who's our protagonist, is thinking about is the loss of his wife and son, who he's convinced are dead, but they're not. And wackiness ensues.
I'm absolutely fascinated by the way you take kind of traditional military thriller and meld it with this sci-fi fantasy. I'll admit, I've described your work before as if Tom Clancy wrote the X-Men.
Oh, that's awesome. I appreciate it. My favorite is always say, well, if Harry Potter, instead of going to Hogwarts, had joined the Navy SEALs, that's where you get my stuff.
Well, what I found in Gemini Cell, too, it was almost too like if Tom Clancy wrote Frankenstein.
I'll take it. Fantastic.
Because I've noticed in the reviews that some people equate Gemini Cell to they say zombie soldier. And I'm like, no, it's not. It's more of a Prometheus storyline where he's reanimated in that classic Prometheus type mold. What were you after when you wrote it?
I was actually after a PTSD allegory, if you can believe it. Not to make things heavy right off the bat, but I remember coming back from Iraq and feeling this tremendous sense of disconnection from the rest of humanity. Just sort of like, mm-hmm. not that people were being mean to me or anything like that, but just that I felt that something had shifted in who I was, and I couldn't connect to people in the same way anymore. And I'd go to parties or I'd go on dates or hang out with whatever and feel incredibly lonely, even in the midst of a crowd. And I really wanted to capture that sense of disconnection in a protagonist. And the cool thing about science fiction and fantasy is it lets you tackle these really serious issues at a safe remove. And so this is a really cool way to do it, is that Jim Schweitzer, the protagonist of this book, the man is dead and he ain't coming back to life. And the fact that he can still interact with humanity and be a savior, including the people he loves, this doesn't change the fact that he is now forever outside the communities that he had once lived for. And how does he find a way forward when suddenly all the goalposts have moved and everything has changed? That was really what I set out for. And the reason that
go ahead.
the reason you see all the zombie stuff is Dread Central, which is a major horror outlet, covered the release of the book, and we're talking about it from a zombie perspective. And I'm mercenary enough to know that there was such a big wave of zombie interest in the marketplace, and I definitely was not going to miss out on if people want to call this a zombie book, they can call it a zombie book, because I guess technically it is.
Mike, are you – what? First, let me announce that we will be taking callers tonight. If anyone wants to call in, it's 347-633-9609. And we have a caller. Would you like to go ahead and talk to him?
Yeah, of course.
All right. Area code 305, you are on.
Hi, Mike. This is Pam. How are you?
Hey, Pam. How are you?
I'm good.
Oh, no, colleague.
I've been following your Facebook post, and I love the fact that you're traveling and you're finding all these great little, you know, historical items and things like that. A lot of times when I talk to writers, they tell me that they like to follow in their characters' footsteps. How about you?
Man, it's interesting. It's more like my characters have followed in my footsteps. So much of my life in the intelligence community and in the military has been spent hopping from base to base. Actually, when we were talking before the show, Terry, I told you I hadn't been out to the Midwest, and that wasn't true because I was at Offutt in Omaha, in Nebraska, for a military conference out there. So I have such a pantheon of experiences related to military bases that feature largely in my in my world. I also worked at the Pentagon, where a lot of the initial action in the Shadow Ops series takes place. The magical worlds, the places like the Source and the Void, where you'll see Jim Schweitzer going, they're extrapolated from, you know, the things that had resonance to me when I was reading fantasy, the Darryl Sweet covers of Tolkien books and things like that. So the answer is yes, but the opposite. Less that I'm following in the footsteps of my characters, and I'm kind of forcing my characters to follow in my own footsteps.
Very cool. And I want to say you're one of my favorite fantasy authors, and especially because – what's your cat's name?
My cat's name? Oh, my cat's
name.
So cat. We're not PG-13 on the show, are we?
No, we're so not PG-15 now.
Okay, so the cat's full name is Al Fuck. What the fuck did you do that for? I wasn't even fucking touching you. And
okay.
the short name that I give to the vet and other people is just Al Fuck. And there's been a concerted campaign from vets, from well-meaning relatives, from friends, that I cannot name the cat that. And the truth is I absolutely can name the cat that. And the
I can,
you're right. And the cat's name should reflect its personality. And this she's like, I don't know if you watched the Pink Panther series, but if you remember that Inspector Clouseau had this assassin that he lived with who would keep his martial arts skills sharp by attacking him when he never expected it.
Yes.
That's what my life without Fuck is. It's just constantly something coming out of left
field. Well, I had to laugh because you posted about being covered in cat hair, and I kind of posted back saying, oh, suck it up, guy. You know, I've got 5. You've got 1. But thank you so much for talking to me. I'm enjoying the show. I'm going
to
go now. Thank you, Terry.
Oh, well, thank you. Thank you. Great
thank you, Pam.
To you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
That's actually a really good lead-in to you have an amazing social media presence.
Oh, thank you. I guess, than I thought it would be, and I certainly have my social media jealousies. I'm sure you're familiar with my longstanding rivalry with Sam Sykes, which is continuing to evolve. I mean, the guy, I'll put in hours and hours, you know, working on these really, really detailed ancient history jokes, and then Sam will tweet fart and 20,000 people will like it. And it's very, very upsetting.
Well, but that's just Sam. I mean, did you read the back and forth between Sam and Chuck Wendig, their horror movie?
And it turned into this media thing, like all of these major venues are picking up on it. And Felicia Day was talking about it. And I got to say, for all of the inane and crazy stuff that Sam puts out there, that was pretty clever and pretty cool on both of their parts.
That was funny as hell. It was really,
yeah, it was brilliant.
And it just kind of sprung up between the two of them. It's like, dude, I'm wearing this mask.
And what I love about it too, is it's like this, it's like spontaneous fiction. It's using, I mean, not to make it too serious, of course I make everything serious, but it's like a story told, like a spontaneous story told in another medium that really, really click with people. Like really click with people. It's still getting currency. Newspapers are still talking about it.
That was a spontaneous outbreak of frivolity. I'm sure you were outraged.
There will be no frivolity on my watch, I'll tell you that. There will be none of that bullshit.
That is one of the funniest things you do, are your your spontaneous outrage at frivolity.
Well, I just feel like a cute little pigs and puppies sniffing flowers. They never got a goddamn thing done, Terry. And we have very, very limited time in this world, so I just try to keep people focused.
And I responded to that with a picture of my cat sitting in a box.
Yeah,
so
I
wanted you to know that I totally understood. But what you've also done too is you've become an apex of a social media community. One of the points. And I thoroughly enjoy it. I look forward to reading what you post. It gets your message out there, and you're starting to turn it into a platform for other socially important things, and I commend you on that.
Well, thanks very much. I was telling you before the show, I'm really involved with a progressive veterans organization called Vote Vets, and I finally reached the point where they're reaching out to me on occasion to ask me to boost the signal on things, and hopefully I'll be able to make some videos, sort of getting political points. I think I just think that it's important to hear both sides of the veterans' position on current affairs. And I'm glad that Vote Vets is always like a voice for me when I was sort of first becoming politically aware in this particular election.
Yes.
It's really an honor to get to help them out.
And I agree with you on that. My brother, who is a Vietnam veteran, has views very, very similar to yours. And he taught me a lot of what I know about, that like any other group in the world there is out there, veterans are obviously not a monolith.
No, sure not.
And that the getting the voices out there and that type of thing. And my brother shared a lot of the same disconnect and discontent you felt when he came home from Vietnam. So, it's definitely not a unique experience by any means.
Yeah, for sure. And you'll have to – and thank your brother for his service when you next you talk to him. I'm certainly sure some guys would take issue with the statement, but I definitely feel that Nam was a heck of a lot rougher in a lot of ways than how I had it in Iraq.
Every one of the experiences had its both unique challenges and lighthearted moments. I mean, he was aboard ship, and he'll tell me some he told me some just hilarious stories about, when you can up a bunch, 1,500 22-year-old guys on a ship, and just absolutely hilarious stories. He also tells me about being in the command center of his ship when it's being buzzed by VC patrol boats. It's just amazing experiences. And you already hit on how you've managed to integrate a lot of your own personal experiences into your books, even though they're in many cases out there fantasy. You've grounded a lot of it in your own experiences, correct?
Mm. Yeah, for sure.
And I want to say your action scenes, like the opening scene in Gemini Cell, is just fantastic.
Well, thanks. I think that so much of that comes from one of the big jobs I did downrange was being an intel operator attached to direct action teams. So you have to remember that, direct action units, guys like the SEALs, their job, they're amazing and they're brilliant. But their primary job and the job they have to be focused on is killing people and destroying property, right? That's what they do.
Yes.
And they need people who are ready to answer questions in the moment and are ready to ask questions in the moment. And, if you hit a target and, there's seven people you're going after and one of them gets away, well, the first question you have is, where the heck did he go? And someone has to be able to answer that question. So I got to spend a lot of time working directly with guys in that of that stripe. And although I want to be clear, I certainly was not one of them. But what that did do is, you know, you joke with them, you hang out with them. It was really funny. We would get back to the base and they would always joke around and say, do you want to roll, which is their term for their what they call MAC, Modern Army Combatives. It's sort of their jujitsu that they would do with each other. And I'd be like, no, I do not want to roll. I'm not letting you put your hands on me. Get the hell away from me. You're not touching me. No way. I've seen what you do to people. But anyway, you sort of get that ethic and you see how they operate. And you combine that with your own training. Give me an edge in being able to describe it in a way that resonates. And I'm still friends. Excuse me. I'm still friends with a lot of guys who are either prior from the teams, still in the teams, that I have a network of people I can reach out to and ask questions of. And I can even have, in some cases, look over my work, which is hugely, hugely helpful. That initial absence scene that you see in Gemini Cell was looked at by my buddy Ted, who was downrange with the teams. And he gave me a lot of really, really valuable insight into how it should run.
And it shows. A friend of mine, a literary agent friend of mine, said the one thing that she's looking for is she's always looking for what she calls the tang of authenticity. Mm-hmm. That even if something maybe is not exactly how it works in real life, she wants to be, she wants you to convince her it is, at least for the time.
To feel that
and
way.
And your action scenes have that tang of authenticity.
Oh, I really appreciate
like
it. It's funny though, that's actually a cause of insecurity for me.
Hang on, you're a little bit fuzzy. Slow down just a little bit.
Oh, I'm sorry. Can you hear me okay now?
That's perfect. Okay, now you were saying?
Okay. I was saying it's a little bit of a source of insecurity for me. I mean, I'm thrilled. Obviously, that is what I want. But one of the mm-hmm. things I started getting is everybody used to say, you know, your writing feels militarily authentic, and that is what makes it great. And I started to wonder, well, shoot, but what if I wrote something else, something not military, not modern military story? Would people still like my writing? Am I a good writer, objectively, outside of the gimmick of being militarily authentic? And that was the whole impetus initially for me to write the Sacred Throne trilogy. So when, because that's a straight up dark medieval fantasy, and when I sold that mm-hmm. series to Tor.com, that was a huge affirmation for me. Because as much as I wanted to prove to all of you guys that I could do it, I really wanted to prove to myself that I could do it. Selling that series, you know, cemented that for me. It was at least personally, it was a big deal.
Why, look, we have a segue. Why don't you tell me about the Sacred Throne series?
So the Sacred Throne series is and anyone who's seen the cover art that was posted on The Verge recently will notice the Warhammer 40K vibe. I freely and completely cop to the influence. It is definitely that bleak, bleak, hopeless tone of grimdark fiction that you get in the Warhammer 40K series and from writers like, you know, Joe Abercrombie, Peter V. Brett, George R. R. Martin, Scott Lynch. I would argue Robin Hobb. A lot of people get on me when I say that Robin Hobb is a grimdark writer, but I absolutely think she is. That sense of bleakness and with a tiny hint of redemption at the end was something I really wanted to explore. And it's a medieval story, and it's about this sort of a religious order that is bent on preventing the devils in hell from crossing this magical barrier and entering our world and harming us. And the way that barrier is broken is when wizards use magic. So they, you know, destroy magic wherever they can find it. And their motto is suffer no wizard to live. And they have incredible draconian rules about people who harbor and help wizards. And they basically sort of rule the world with an iron fist. It's a very dark and awful universe to live in. And this one little girl, Waz, who is the protagonist of the series, decides that she doesn't want to live that way and resists the order. But just because the order is draconian doesn't mean they're wrong. And so wackiness ensues.
Rules are there for a reason sometimes.
Right.
Yes.
Right. That's right. So
one thing I see, and we have it both in Armored Saint and in Siege Line, is you are not afraid to write strong female characters. And A, I
no,
appreciate
I am,
that.
No, thanks.
And B, where does
I'm
it come from?
I'm hell-bent on it, in fact. It comes from where you think. Look, man, art is not the place to play it safe, right? It really isn't. Like, mm-hmm. every successful work of art has been an outlier. You think of George R. R. Martin writing Game of Thrones, the book, the first book, Game of Thrones, and his decision to kill Ned Stark. And I'm sure his editor, his agent, everybody's like, oh, you can't do that. You know, you can't kill your protagonist randomly and capriciously like that. And I'm sure George R. R. Martin doubted himself. And I'm sure in the end he said, no, I'm the artist, you're not, and I'm going to do this. And it turned out to be this groundbreaking thing that that changed the whole conversation in fantasy and ushered in, you know, new public expectations of what fantasy could and should be. So I could look, my life experience is that of a socially enfranchised middle-class white dude, and I could write those guys. There's certainly enough of an audience for that, and I'm sure I could continue to sell books. But if I want to truly make great art, as Neil Gaiman says, and I want to truly try to push the envelope, I might fail in the process, but if I want to be one of these major authors, a George R. R. Martin, a China Mieville, a Naomi Novik, like somebody who is changing the conversation, then I have to take risks. And I'm not going to do that writing characters that are safe and that I know. And also, one of the cool things about writing is that it's an opportunity to grow personally. It's an opportunity to experience things and interrogate things and explore things I never would otherwise. I don't know, readers will, if they read Gemini Cell, they'll see that there's a sex scene in that book from the point of view of a woman. That was scary as hell to write that. Because, look, I mean, I'm a 43-year-old man, and I hope this doesn't come across as bragging, but I've actually had sex before. When you're a guy, you have no idea how women experience sex. And, in fact, you don't even think about it. You know, it's like driving a car. You get in, you turn the key, it makes the right noises, it operates the way it's supposed to, so you assume that everything's fine. But the fact of the matter is that there's a lot more going on, right? And one of the huge one of the huge like shameful things for me, embarrassing things for me, was when I realized in my 40s that I had never sat down and asked myself, how do women experience sex? Really experience it in detail. Like, what is going on down at the most minute levels when that's happening? And I had never really thought about it. And I was humiliated that I'd never really thought about it. And so I then went through this series of really, really awkward conversations, including with my best friend's girlfriend. Thank you, Lauren, for being willing to like have this really wanting to crawl out of our own skin conversation where I'm asking, you know, exactly how are you feeling? What is going on here? What is going on here? And then I wrote the scene from a woman's point of view, trying to encapsulate, you know, what sex in this context felt like. My editor is a woman. So when I got it past her, oh, and also the author, Carrie Vaughn, I don't know if you've read her work. She's really first class, amazing, amazing writer, but she was also willing to read it and let me know if I was missing the mark or being creepy. And when I passed that bar, at least to the respect that, I mean, your readers will judge, but that I have these two women that are telling me this resonates with them, I really, really felt like, holy shit, how lucky am I? I just had a chance to grow up a little bit and to develop myself as a person. And, like, what's writing for if not that, right?
No, and that is great. And you did a good job. You really did. It was well done. And you've also through social media and everything, you've talked about some of the women that you served with when you were in the Coast Guard. Did those women help drive any of your characters?
Well, I mean, of course, but you remember, you got to be really careful there because I'm an officer or was an officer in the Coast Guard. So the women that I was working with, for the most part, were working for me. So it was super, super important that I was 1,000% focused on, you know, treating them like sailors and getting them the enfranchisement they needed to do their jobs most effectively and making sure that they were treated as effective members of the team. But sure, I looked around at military women left and right and saw the different pressures they were under, the different stressors they were under. And let's face it, as much as I wish this wasn't the case, women in the military have a much, much, much tougher road to hoe than men do. And it's changing. It's getting better. It's certainly not getting better fast enough. But there's a lot to see in that grit, and a lot that was a huge influence in the characters I developed.
Well, yeah, because you worked with some darn badasses.
I sure did, left and right. It was pretty impressive. I'm very, very lucky. And in fact, one of my MK3s when I was running Station New York, absolute badass, who joined up and came. She deliberately went to the MK rating. That's the machinist mate rating. It's a tough, totally male-dominated gearhead rating in the Coast Guard. And the collateral duty of it is you're working on engines, but your collateral duty is law dog. You're a law enforcer, so you're carrying the gun. You're picking down the hatches. And she deliberately chose that because she wanted to test her. She didn't want to test her metal doing, occupying traditionally female occupied roles in the military. She wanted to challenge assumptions. And she got a rash of shit from these guys left and right, and it did not stop her, and she was amazing. And she lives in my neighborhood now, and we're both out of the Coast Guard to see her around and say hi to her. And she's an inspiration on and off the field. It's amazing.
You're fuzzing on me just a little bit, so just slow down. You're doing great. So that's got to be the freaking safest neighborhood between you, her, and ow, fuck. I mean, that is a safe neighborhood right there.
I think my neighborhood is safe now by virtue of a lot of rich tech bros and young families are moving in. This is Brooklyn, man. We're we're pretty well healed out here, so not too much crime in my neighborhood.
Well, and how many of all the people in our neighborhood, how many of them have a shower that has its own Twitter account?
Yeah, that's true. I'm probably the only one. And can I just say, I have nothing to do with the proliferation of Twitter accounts related to my pets, my rigging appliances, my bookshelves. Like, it is nuts. Somebody out there has got a hard-on for Twitter accounts related to the various, tangentials in my life. It's hysterical. I'm very gratified.
Well, and that's the funny part too, because it shows too just your integration, your creation of this social media network, this family that people become part of.
And this is the thing that is awesome about social media, is that you really don't have to do that much. You just have to get out there and be welcoming, and then all of these people. Because, look, people always say, social media isn't real communication. I always want to kick them in the beanbag because, yes, it is. It's absolutely real communication. It's a new form of communication. And the proof is what you just described. All of these people, you put out a welcome mat and say, this is my style of humor. This is what I like in life. And all of these people pile on and just build this thing with you. And the next thing you know, you're surrounded by this big community of folks. I mean, Terry, how long have you and I known each other through Twitter before this is the first time we've spoken in person?
It's ever since you wrote that one, the blog post about the trans friend. So it's been, at least 2-3 years, correct?
Yeah, 2-3 years. That's right. That's right.
Yeah.
And I feel
and
like we've had lots of conversations in that time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I tell people the same thing. It's what lets me live in a small town and not, go up a bell tower with a high-powered rifle, So it's for the safety of everybody. No, I call it tribe building, and you've done an excellent job of it, and I'm very honored to be part of your tribe because I thoroughly enjoy it.
For sure. Well, now, I wouldn't be a tribe without you.
A couple of questions about Hunted.
Sure.
I want to say how much I enjoyed the show Hunted. It just absolutely fascinated me. For one thing, I was a criminal defense attorney for almost 15 years. Mm. So watching it, I felt like I was sometimes even watching my clients going, okay, here's where he's going to get caught because your family can't lie for shit, man. I got a call once from somebody going, that guy that they want downtown? I'm like, well, which one? And he told me the name. He said he's out hiding someplace because what it is the guy messed with the guy's daughter. So dad was diming the guy out. And I started making calls to the cops and the DA. I finally called my friend who was the DA. And, it's like, you really need to get out there and get this guy. You've got a fugitive warrant on him. And they went out and they found him. He was hiding in an industrial dryer.
Oh, my God.
Oh, I know. I wonder how, if any of the cops were just tempted to hit on.
Yeah, hit turn it on, right, yeah.
But one question I wanted to ask about it is, how much off-screen time went into the work that your team did? Because obviously we saw an edited together greatest hits reel, essentially, on the show.
So this is going to shock you, but zero. We came out early before the show began to set up the command center, because we weren't just the stars of the show. We were also the law enforcement consultants for the show. So we helped design that command center, pick the tools, set up the processes by which we would route information. We basically imitated what we do in real life to produce that effect on the show. However, to keep the game fair, because remember, there's a lot of money on the line here. And so CBS has a whole unit called Standards and Practices, which is this army of lawyers that hover over everything everybody does, especially in game show environments like this one, to make sure that, you know, if some contestant loses and then they sue, that CBS has an ironclad argument for why this was a fair game. So one of the rules they had was this was a real hunt, which means that we were stood up and the fugitives were stood up and they were running and we were hunting. And when timeout was called because, you know, it was bedtime or whatever it was, if the fugitives weren't running, we were not hunting, period. And
really?
If we were caught,
okay.
Absolutely. If we were caught doing work, doing research, doing anything offset when the hunt was not officially on, we could get in really serious trouble. And one of the first things that happened when we got there is we were all indemnified by contract for $5 million. And CBS had that $5 million leash around each one of our necks. And believe me, when you have a $5 million leash around your neck, you obey the rules. So none of us did anything.
Well, I watched, they did a Facebook Live, two of the team members, and I'm blanking on who they were, but the guy asked, he said, for one of the first things he asked is, well, can't we just ping the cameras on the cameramen? I'm sure that got a furrowed brow.
Yeah, so this is the thing, is that CBS, I wish CBS at the time of the show would have let us talk to the audience about the rules.
Mm-hmm.
Because I really feel that one of the big complaints that the audience would say to me about the show is that they thought it was fake. And it wasn't.
Yes.
It was absolutely real. But what CBS, I think CBS's decision was, they didn't want to break the fourth wall. They didn't want to show the hand behind the curtain. And I personally think that was a mistake. I think that the audience is smart. And I think that if we had turned to the audience and said, look, these are the rules, I don't think it would have dispelled the magic for them at all. But anyway, one of the rules was you can't target the camera people. So whenever my job on the show was to triangulate and track cell phones. That was my main gig. So of course, you know, in the course of like dumping cell towers and making common contacts, I would figure out the camera people and camera crew's cell phones and start moving down the road to track them. And as soon as I even got wind of it, sniffed it, the CBS Standards and Practices people would leap out of the shadows and be like, nope, you cannot, you know, leave that phone number alone. You can't look at it, scrub it out of your data. They would intervene to prevent data. When people called in the tip line and reported citing a camera person, CBS operators would intercept that call and not let it get to us. They were religious about preventing any kind of contamination. So the reality of it is, you'd be standing right next to a camera person who would never have any idea, because they were so thorough about making sure we couldn't touch that information.
That's great, because I am.
It is great.
Plus,
I wish they told the audience.
Well, and if I know, and if any reality show ever needed, you know, like that roundup show at the end, you know, where everybody just comes and all sits down and talks to each other about it, it was this one, where you could have talked about. Talked about things like this.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, that scene where she was caught eating the burrito. That was the greatest 10 seconds of TV ever filmed.
It was pretty awesome. It was pretty awesome. It was fantastic. And the best part is that Centra Tran is a huge nerd. She's a cosplayer. She's like a Comic-Con lady. So I was really like, I kind of almost felt bad when we caught them. Now I know that, David Winditcher and Emily Cox live down near Atlanta, and I'm actually heading down that way for Dragon Con in a couple of weeks. So in fact, when I get off this phone call with you, I'm probably going to send them a message and ask them if they want to meet up for lunch or something.
That'd be great, because one thing that was interesting about this premise, too, as opposed to, say, something like Survivor or the other shows, is you could have either had 7 winners or 0 winners.
Yeah, I mean,
the contestants were never pitted against each other. It was always you versus them. And
right.
that made it fascinating. But more than once I was screaming at the scene, haven't you people ever read Barry Eisler? Any of you? Because I don't know if you've read his book, God's Eye.
No, but I know of it.
I highly recommend it, because it's pretty much, it's like, oh, hell no, I'm not doing any of that, you know, any of that,
right.
that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like there was one time where I honestly thought you guys had maybe hacked into the car's Bluetooth or something like that.
I don't think we hacked Bluetooth, but we did compromise car GPS. And I think this actually captured in one of the episodes where we did that, where we were tracking the car via its onboard GPS.
Yeah, that's what I said. When they ran on Twitter that thing, you know, what's your list of, what's your hunted list? You know, mine is like, disable the Bluetooth in my van, check the tires for RFID, RFID tags, get rid of my SIM cards, you know, that type of things. So it's like, dude, I've read Barry Eisler. So it was a fun show to watch, and I really didn't know what was going to happen at the end.
The truth is, Terry, neither did we. That show evolved and unfolded exactly as you saw it, and when those last two couples got away, we were not happy. We were pissed because we really had been working super, super hard to get everybody. Now, the truth is, if you're in the fugitive hunting business, you would know seven teams out of 9 is actually an unspeakably good track record. Like, I mean, in real life, it ain't nearly that good. We really wanted to get them all. We did not want to go home without 100%. We were really, really bummed.
In the real world where I've lived, honestly, what they'll do, I had a client run rabbit. He left the state, and they just lay out a passive net of arrest warrants, and they're sooner or later they're going to step into it. You know, that's how a lot of it's done in real life outside the super duper high profile. Well, it was a fun show to watch, and everything too, like. Your mom's comments on the show just killed me.
Mom. So you have.
I love
like,
your mom.
Oh, my, me too. Mom is great. The thing with my mom is you have to realize it's like my mom is this Jewish New York City intellectual whose entire life has been, you know, in museums and in education. Like reality TV, and it's bizarre enough for my mom that I became, you know, an armed professional and went into first intelligence service and then military service and then law enforcement. Like my mom doesn't know what to do with that to begin with, because it's just not something that Jewish boys do. And then you're on TV doing it, and she was completely at a loss. And then the coolest thing is that she finally figured out how to use Facebook.
Okay.
And my mom was in Mexico. Can you hear me?
Yeah, there you are.
Hello?
So your mom was in Mexico.
My mom lives in Mexico, so, you know, she can live much better down there on less money. So she doesn't, you know, get to talk to me on the phone or visit me as much as she'd like. And I said, well, Mom, you know, you should use Facebook. Facebook is, you know, everything I do is on Facebook, get on Facebook. And so she's been getting on Facebook, you know, in the limited way that she can. And, I mean, of course, my fans just freak out because here I am fencing with my mom on Facebook. And then so every once in a while she'll email us, she'll call me and she'll say, you know, do your friends like me? All of these people are commenting on what I say. I'm like, no, Mom, it's okay. You're definitely welcome. You're a good part of this tribe.
Oh, no. There needs to be like an Instagram that is stuff Mike Cole's mom says, because we love her. Mom, if you're listening, we love you.
I will and definitely pass that on.
The same thing. Well, and it's like your bantering and your back and forth with your brother is the same way. And it's humanizing.
Yeah.
That's one thing I enjoy about social media is it's a humanizing side to everyone.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. Are you familiar with Cory Doctorow? He wrote Big Brother and a lot of other great science fiction.
Yes.
So Cory, it's funny, I'm a big fan of Cory Doctorow's nonfiction, much more so than his fiction, which I actually think I'm probably not alone in that. He's a, you know, he's a noted futurist and one of the world's great essayists. But one of the things he said about science fiction and fantasy fandom is that the way that science fiction and fantasy authors are truly successful is by cultivating superfans. These are like people who undoubtedly love you and, you know, proselytize for your work. And the way that you cultivate these relationships is you build a sense of intimacy and you allow these people to know you in perhaps a little more intimacy than you would with most strangers. And that means like, hey, here's my family, you know, hey, here's my cat, like, here's my life. And the reality of it is I think maybe before the advent of social media, the social media boom that we live in now, it was enough to just present your art. But I think now, more than ever, you're really kind of selling yourself.
And I agree with that 100%, which, why look, segue alert. What's this nonfiction project you've got going on?
Okay. So this is the thing. Most people, I think, if they were starred on a TV show, would like leverage it to do something a little more lucrative. But no, I'm Mike Cole. So the deal is I love ancient history. Love it to the point where I buried myself in it, like really, really learned this stuff and became really interested in particular military formations, most notably the Roman Legion and the Hellenistic phalanx of the 3rd and 2nd centuries BC. But the problem in the history publishing world is it's not like science fiction and fantasy. You don't just write a good book and then you wow an editor and you sell it. You really have to be credentialed. You have to have a PhD in your topic, and you have to teach at a major university. And if you don't have those things, it's going to be really hard to get a publisher to take you seriously. And I knew that. And I always wanted to write this book, which talked about the Legion, the Roman Legion fighting the Greek phalanx, which is amazingly enough, it's like this amazing who would win in a fight topic, because you have these two military formations that fight completely differently and are totally culturally different. And yet in a major contest for the sort of military future of the world. And nobody wrote a book on it. So I was like, I can do that. And like, how am I going to get publishers to take me seriously? I won't dime out this publisher, but one of the publishers I sent the manuscript to, incredibly well written. It's incredibly well researched. You are changing the conversation. You are contributing intellectually to the academic conversation. You're also just writing a great work of pop history. We love it. Unfortunately, we can't buy it because you don't have a PhD. And I sent the dude a link to this online diploma mill where you could spend $45 and buy a PhD, you know. And I was like, I'll just go get one, dude, and it will be the same book that you love, except now I'll have a stupid PhD, and then will you publish it? Now, just a word of advice to your listeners, don't do that, because I will never be able to sell a book to this guy again as long as I live. So don't do that. But it was very satisfying at the time I did it. So instead what I
did... And we'd be able to call you Dr. Cole then.
Oh, something, yeah. Yeah, from the University of Phoenix or whatever, like, you know, silly online university I bought the diploma from. But I used the TV thing. I said, look, if you want to, you know, have an academic writer on here who's going to sell 5 books, then great. But if you want me to come with a built-in audience, and I believe that I can deliver on them, I believe that nerds and sci-fi and fantasy fans also love nerds.
Okay, you're breaking up a little bit.
You got me now?
Got you now. Okay.
Okay, cool. Sorry, it's AT&T.
And I was like,
I believe that I can bring that crossover audience. I believe that nerds, you know, will like that stuff. And then I got super lucky because the publisher that picked me up, Osprey, they have made their living, they certainly have top-notch academic writers, but they also embrace military veterans because they publish strictly military history, and they acknowledge that there's a universality to the military experience and that a veteran who's been to war has something to say about the universal experience of a soldier, even going back to the ancient world, that an academic, it'll be a different perspective from an academic, but also a valid one. And I think between the TV fame and the guaranteed audience and that you know, my experience going to war, I was able to convince them that they really could make something of this book. And I'm so lucky that they gave me my shot.
I mean, this trip to Greece just sounds like it was incredible.
Oh my God, it was so incredible. And it was with another amazing fantasy author named Michael Livingston. His Shards of Heaven series is published by Tor. But what most people don't know about Mike is that not only is he a kick-ass fantasy writer, which is how we became friends, but he also wrote the book on the Battle of Crecy and the Hundred Years' War. If you're an American, this battle may not be as famous to you, but if you grew up in France or England, this is a big deal. And Mike basically proved, really proved, that where we thought the battle was fought hundreds of years is wrong, and that he proved that it's kilometers away. And that was just
wow,
the tiniest sliver of what he proved, yeah. And he proved this to, you know, English people, English professors who believe that, like, you know, they own this story. So he definitely went up against maybe a hostile audience, and he proved it so conclusively that the Society of Military History gave his book on Crecy the Distinguished Book Award for 2017, which is a very big deal if you write military history. Mike is a professor at the Citadel in South Carolina.
Wow, what a trip that must have been. Well, and one thing you can bring to it, too, is you know how to write a damn action scene.
Oh, well, thanks. Yeah, I'm trying to keep it dramatic, but also stick to the facts of the case.
One thing, too, just to pick up something you tweeted about one day, is you said that the HBO series Rome was actually not that bad from a historical standpoint.
Not only not that bad, but quite good.
I love that show.
Me too. And I don't know if you know this, Terry, but it's a, you know, it's a progenitor to Game of Thrones. The whole reason that Game of Thrones was able to be so sweeping and such of an epic scope is that the mechanisms for building a show like that were laid down by Rome.
There's a line in it that it always sticks with me. It's where he has raised loyalty to the level of a vice. When they're and everything about it was just amazing. And I will say, when something's done well that way, in a dramatic way, you learn and you become interested. You know,
and that's the thing. That is the thing, is that I really feel like, you know, Game of Thrones is fantasy, but it's not so off of the politics and scheming of the actual real-life Wars of the Roses, that if you were to make a series about the Wars of the Roses or make a series about the scheming that occurred after the death of Alexander the Great, I think you'd find an audience for both.
Well, when are we going to see the nonfiction book out? Does it have a date yet?
I believe you're going to see it in 2018. It's going to be called Legion versus Phalanx, and it will be published by Osprey. And for those of you that love military history, one of the things that Osprey does so well is all of their books are highly, highly illustrated. They hire these amazing artists to execute paintings based on the material evidence and the directions of the authors that give you as close to a photograph of medieval and ancient battles and even modern ones as you could possibly get.
That's amazing. So I'm going to play your personal secretary here for a second, because you are a busy guy. Make sure I get the siege line, which is it the third and final book of the Gemini Cell storyline?
Right. So it's the third and final book of the prequel series. And sadly, it is also the final. It's going to close out the whole Shadow Ops effort. So
okay.
Those six books will be the six Shadow Ops books you get.
And that one is due out on October 31st of 2017.
Correct.
Okay. Now we have The Armored Saint, which is the first book in the Sacred Throne, I don't know, series, trilogy, what?
Trilogy, yep. Trilogy.
Epic, okay. It's coming out in February 20th of 2018.
Correct.
So everybody... And then your nonfiction book with Osprey is sometime 2018, most likely, but you don't have a date yet, correct?
I don't have a date yet, but I think it'll be close to the release date of Armored Saint.
Sweet. That is excellent.
Yeah.
Well, and too, like you said, Osprey puts so much work into their books that we'll have a date when we have a date.
That's
but that
sure.
It will most likely be in 2018. And now, what is this, as far as conferences go, you said you're going to be at Dragon Con?
Oh, man, my schedule's nuts. So I've got Dragon Con in September, In October, I'm actually doing two cyber threat intelligence talks, one for a conference of financial CEOs in Boston, one for a cyber threat intelligence company called Recorded Future, and I'll be speaking for them in Washington, D.C. Then I'm flying back to New York and going right into New York City Comic Con, which is awesome. And if folks are willing to travel out here for that, it's one of the great Comic Cons. And then in November, I'm going to be at Gamehole Con, which is out in Madison, Wisconsin. And it's a all-weekend gaming-only con, sort of like a mini Gen Con. And I'm really excited to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yep, you're going to be kind of busy on that. And
for
then
sure.
You've also got you've got this guest bartending gig coming up. Tell me about that.
Right. So, look, I've made no secret about my politics, and fortunately there's a lot of people that agree with me in New York. So this group of bartenders that had a lot of success with a bar, they opened up another bar in Union Square in New York City, and this bar, 100% of its profits go to charities that are opposed to the current administration and that are working to abet causes that are under attack by the current administration. And when you're a guest bartender, you can pitch which charities you want. So I'm going to be bartending on Tuesday night, August 22nd, starting from 5 p.m. to 11. And the bar is called Coop, C-O-U-P, and it's in mm-hmm. Union Square. I hope folks will come out. And 100% of the profits from that night, including my wages and my tips for working that bar, are going to be going to benefit my three charities, which are going to be the American Civil Liberties Union, the ACLU, Planned Parenthood, and Trans Lifeline.
And what was that date again?
August 22nd. And I really hope folks will come out. You're more than welcome. I'm going to be too busy to say hi to people, but I'll definitely pour you a drink.
So that's it. And it's for a good cause. And I wish I could be there because that would be absolutely fantastic.
Yeah, I wish you could be there too, but you'll be there in spirit. We'll raise a glass to you.
Absolutely. You promise you'll come back on when some of these new books start coming out?
For sure. Are you kidding me? This is a blast.
I felt like we barely even scratched the surface. I could keep you on the line for quite a while, but my studio is going to expire here in a few minutes, so I've got to get a little
Fair
housekeeping
enough.
I want to thank you for coming in, and this by tomorrow morning, this will be archived as a podcast. I'm going to send you the link to it. I'll also post the link, so anybody who missed it, they'll be able to catch up on what we talked about. And
great.
If anyone who's listening, if you enjoyed this show, well, this broadcast is made possible by the support of Down and Out Books. They're celebrating 6 years of award-winning crime fiction and scored 6 nominations at this year's Anthony Awards that'll be at BoucherCon this year in Toronto. You can check them out at downandoutbooks.com. One thing that's cool about Down and Out is they are also really supporting the novella format in crime books. So it's good to see that coming back. And this podcast is owned and copyrighted by the Authors on the Air Radio Network, LLC. You can follow the Blue Plate Special on Facebook to keep up with our broadcast schedule. And Mike, thanks for coming in, and I look forward to talking to you again soon.
Terry, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. Good night now.
Good night.